And now a Tailwind nutrition tip from none other than Anna Frost. Anna, what do you have for us today?
Well, I think in any sort of training, consistency and patience is the key. You have to maintain that to get anywhere. You can't just go out and force it all at once. But the main priority I think that you should all be aiming for is enjoyment and passion. That if your heart is not really in it, then you're not going to get through those hard steps and the hard miles when things don't always go your way. Your heart has to be saying to you, yes, come on, we can do this and carry on. So the passion and the heart, the love for what you're doing, whatever it is the thing that will drive you forward.
So do you ever get to the point where it's not fun for you? And you have to do some reevaluation?
I haven't so far. I guess when at the point when you get injured, then you think this is not fun and you have to reevaluate, and that's when you stop and take a break and work through it. But in terms of running, I've never got to the point where I don't love it anymore. And at that point when I get there, then if I ever get there, then I know it will be time to make a change and to follow my heart in a different direction.
Well, I think that you've probably figured out the balance piece of it, because there is a way to do it where you're always pushing and always demanding and always looking at the clock and always trying to beat your last whatever it is and filling up a logbook, that it could become more of a task than a pleasure and yeah. No longer be a passion, but just brutal. And
yeah.
And so I think your Tailwind nutrition tip is great, that you mm-hmm. you always make sure that you're enjoying it and remembering it is our passion and what we
yeah,
do for
exactly.
pleasure.
It's a hobby, right?
Well, for
yeah,
some,
exactly.
some of it's for Anna, it's a job. But
yeah.
most of us, it's
yeah.
a hobby. It's wonderful to love your job, isn't it, Anna?
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, I'm super lucky.
Well, thanks for that tip. We will keep balance, and balance is important, so we appreciate it. Thanks, Anna. You know, Scott, there seems to be a theme, and that's balance. Balance in our training, balance in our life, balance in sleep, all that stuff, balance.
You know, balance is good.
It's critical. Without it, you get lopsided and you fall over.
And one of the things that I like about Tailwind nutrition is that it has... It's not just an electrolyte drink. It has some balance. It has
Scott. What's in that thing? What's in Tailwind Nutrition exactly?
With each scoop, which you want to mix with about 12 ounces of water, each scoop has 100 calories.
Critical.
So that's like a goo.
It keeps you moving down the road.
So it has the calories, but it also has the key electrolytes that you need.
What do you got? Read off some stats.
It has some sodium. It has some potassium, it has calcium, and of course, it's got to have magnesium.
Scott, that's the essential stuff.
Yeah, so it's really all you need all day.
Put some in the bottle, rub some on your legs, take a bath with it.
I find by taking a pinch and throwing it over your left shoulder, it's good luck for you.
But in crowded trail environment, be careful, Scott, because if you throw Tailwind in somebody's eyes, it will not be a performance enhancer.
That's true. So go to tailwindnutrition.com, take the Tailwind Challenge. They have some samples there. So if you're not sure what flavor you like, just get a sample pack and try it. See if it works for you.
Go out and drink.
Moss.
And another Petzl running strategy, this one brought to you by racer, race director,
and good friend,
Julie Fingar. Julie, who's getting ready right now for defending Headlands 100 title.
Are you actually running right now, Julie?
In my thoughts, yes.
So we thought we'd ask Julie, as she's coming up on a big race, 100-mile distance, how do you keep cool? What do you do the day before to get ready to make sure you get sleep, eat right? Tell us some tricks. What do you have, Julie?
Gosh, tricks of the trade. Stay hydrated, drink lots of water, and not only water, but some electrolyte, so I don't flush out my sodium stores with just plain water, and just make sure that I'm eating throughout the day, because as it gets later in the day, it's harder for me to eat as my stomach gets a little jittery. So I want to make sure that I got some early calories in my body, and you know, really just kind of just calm myself and just actually try to distract, watch a little TV, and try to put my feet up and just relax for the day.
Julie, we know that you're a huge proponent of yoga. Do you do any, like, yoga meditation the night before?
I did it this morning, actually. I got up and did some sun salutations and a little sunflower and some warriors, and I'm good to go.
Hey, so what time do you try to hit the hay, Julie? It's early morning start, this race tomorrow. What time do you finally say, that's it, I'm turning off the lights, I'm going to bed?
Usually around 9, nothing too early. Otherwise, my body's not used to going to bed. Even 9 will be stretching it, as my normal bedtime is usually 11 or later. So, you know, just start winding down at 9 and probably fall asleep around 10:30, 11. And as long as I get a couple good hours of that REM sleep, I'll be ready to go.
Well, right on, Julie. We appreciate you sharing some of your thoughts, ideas, and techniques before a big race, and wish you the very best tomorrow as you're going to go out there and climb up and down the hills at Marin Headlands 100.
Thanks.
And this is brought to you by Petzl.com. Headlands 100, I bet you there's going to be many Petzl headlamps out there shining the way for the runners running through the night.
We depend on good light out there. There's just no way you can get through these long courses without some artificial sun strapped to the top of our head. And and that's what the Petzl lamp is.
Artificial sun.
That's kind of what I'm calling it from here on out. Julie, good luck this weekend.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Bye-bye.
Go out and run.
Mas.
Thanks. Bye.
Are we recording?
Faith, give me a little 1-2.
1-2.
1-3-4-5-6.
Check.
I'm not really a morning person, so.
And it was a miserable, miserable day.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Faith Goss.
I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott Warren. Today we have JB Benna on the line with us, on the hook with us.
Yeah.
And if you don't know who JB Benna is, go to www, that's World Wide Web for you, Don.
Thank you.
Journeyfilm.com, which is his film company. He makes films, and there's a lot of different films on there, but you're probably most familiar with some of the runs like Unbreakable, which was the run between Killian Howell and Anton in 2000.
And Jeff Rose.
Jeff Rose.
Let's not forget Jeff.
And that was in 2010. That's right. And there's some others on there that are actually pretty good. I knew about Unbreakable, of course, because we own that.
The DVD. We own one DVD. We don't own the film.
No.
JB owns the film.
But there's some other really cool videos or DVDs on there. One is The Runner, which is, of course, David Horton.
Uh-huh.
You know David Horton.
Sure.
We all know David Horton and his 700-mile run of the PCT.
Right.
And which is the Pacific Crest Trail.
Thank you, Faith. And then there's also one that I was not aware of, but I think I'm going to go check it out. And it's Andy Skurka, who's, if you're into fast packing and backpacking and stuff like that, Andy Skurka is like the man. And I guess it's a film about the Great Western Loop, which is almost a 7,000-mile backpacking loop. So anyway, Journey Film is where you can find JB Benna, but that's not why we have him on the line today. We have him on the line because JB Benna just broke the fastest known time unsupported, and we'll define that in a minute, unsupported fastest known time for the Tahoe Rim Trail. So thanks for joining us, JB.
Thanks for having me, guys. Pleasure to be on the show again.
So here's my, first of all, we need to define what unsupported is. And I have actually the definition from fastest known time. If you go to fastestknowntime.com, it kind of puts out the requirements or the definitions of some of this stuff.
Before we even go there, I'd like to know, if I was somebody that didn't live on the West Coast, what is the Tahoe Rim Trail? How long is it? Where is it located? JB, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, for sure. The Tahoe Rim Trail is the distance is changing. It used to be about 165, but over the years, after they've added new sections to bypass populated areas and difficult parts, it's become nearly 175 miles. I think I clocked it at about 174. Basically it just circumnavigates the entire lake up mostly near the rim and goes through the most beautiful parts of the Tahoe area, the Desolation Wilderness, Granite Chief, Mount Rose Wilderness. So very beautiful and stunning trail, and it happens to be right in my backyard. I live about 15 minutes away from it in the Reno area, and run on it pretty consistently. So that is the Tahoe Rim Trail, and one of my reasons for doing it, just being so close.
Is there an exact start and stop location that you have to use if you're going to do the fastest known time?
You know, I was wondering that myself, but there actually has not been. It's kind of been self-selective. Since it is a loop trail, it's unique in that way, where people kind of select their start point based off of where they think it'll be, you know, the direction and the starting point that they think will benefit them the most. And so in a certain respect, that is kind of a game of chess, I guess. And then also you can go either direction. You can go counterclockwise or clockwise. And I did actually end up switching at the very last minute, less than 2 hours before I decided to hike. I changed from counterclockwise to clockwise. So,
Holy cow, that's
fine.
A big change.
That's fine, but you don't want to make that change like 2 hours left in the run. That would be a bad move.
I did actually do that at about a mile 120. I changed directions 2 miles and realized I had made a mistake. And so, yeah, I did. but yeah, you know what happened? My initial plan was to go start from Spooner Summit, and the reason being was because the east side lake has the longest dry sections. There's nearly a 50 mile dry section on the west or east side of the lake, and so I actually started right in the middle of that section, which broke it up into 25 mile sections instead of a 50 mile section. So that was my strategic decision. And then my initial plan was to go clockwise or counterclockwise. But then the day I woke up to do the run, the weather forecast had changed from 72 degrees to 70 mile an hour winds and a 30-50% chance of rain. And the part that I was going to start on was extremely exposed, way up high on these ridges, where I knew the wind was just going to be knocking me over. So I changed direction in order to kind of take some shelter from the wind. The wind actually ended up letting up for most of the hike, but I can talk more about that later. But anyway, to get back to the supported versus unsupported, the fastest known time page kind of lays out some ground rules, I guess. Unsupported, you have to actually carry all your own food and supplies. You can't receive any outside assistance. You can't ask people for things along the way. And you're supposed to get all your water from natural sources. Though, you know, they also do just say, you know, as long as you're open and honest about your intentions and how you're going to go about the hike, that, you know, that can stand as well. So I did lay all that out. You know, I did carry all my own food. I did use only natural water sources. I did have my wife and photographer meet me at Mount Rose Meadows, just mostly as a verification, but also just to take a few photos. But they were both there together just to make sure that neither one of them handed me anything or hugged me or gave me any encouragement that would be considered support.
So they didn't hike with me. Are hugs considered support?
I didn't want to take a chance, so yeah, Jen did not even touch me, which was, you know, probably good. But then obviously when I did finish, yeah, there was lots of hugs and support at that point, and support getting to the car and walking for the next few days.
So how many people have attempted the unsupported? Do you have any idea?
You know, I'm not 100% sure, but I know not very many people have successfully completed it. I know a bunch have attempted it because people post, you know, fairly regularly on the fastest known time page that they're going to attempt it. And some report back, some you never hear from them again. But I think, as far as I know, I think there's only been maybe 3 successful completions of the entire trail unsupported. But there's been, you know, dozens other that have attempted it unsuccessfully. I know Michael Mish Popov had the record at 63 hours and 54 minutes. And he had successfully done it before in like 77 hours. And then, Adam Bradley, who was the previous PCT record holder, or fastest known time holder, had done the Tahoe Rim Trail in 88 hours prior to that. And those are the only like successful attempts that I'm aware of. But then again, a lot of people have tried to beat Michael's record over the last few years.
How much help do you get from people that have either successfully made it or you know, learned some lessons along the way? Are the other runners a good resource in something like this?
Yeah, you know, I mean, they, you know, just to be courteous, they always suggest that you kind of reach out to the previous record holder and, you know, state your intentions. Unfortunately, as many people know, Michael Mish Popov actually passed away in Death Valley in 2012, and so he's no longer with us. But one of his, you know, good friends and partners in adventure, who was also there with him during his, you know, Tahoe Rim record attempts, was Sarah Spelt, who used to be the founder, or was the founder of PCTR Trail Runs back in the day. So big, you know, ultra running proponent and just a good person. And so I reached out to her, actually, you know, just to let her know that I was going to be doing this attempt and that I was going to be doing it in Michael's honor, and you know, just kind of asking for her blessing. But also she offered advice as well, which was very helpful. And but yeah, that was the only person that I really reached out to. And then just kind of planned most of it myself, utilizing my kind of my experience from the Pacific Crest Trail and my ultralight backpacking experience in combination with my ultra running experience. And I think it really, those two things combined really made it a kind of perfect event for me, I guess. And I think it really suited my skills, I guess, is why one reason why I went for it. So I didn't actually think I could be successful on my first attempt for a few reasons. One, I'm not in the best shape that I could be. And two, the trail is actually 5 miles longer now than when Mish set the record in 2011. So between those two things, I would just was a little bit hesitant to, you know, have the confidence that I could actually do it.
You know, first of all, I had a couple questions. One, have you thru-hiked the PCT?
Yeah, I did a thru-hike PCT in 2000 when I was 21. That was kind of my first ever endurance event, well before I started ultra-running.
Okay. And then I want to get into this whole unsupported thing. You have to carry all of your food. You have to be strategic in where you're going to get water. First of all, were you filtering the water, or are you just drinking out of the natural water sources and just hope that it's not going to hit? If there's something in there, it's not going to bother you till after you're done.
Yeah, no, I was filtering. I initially was looking at the lightest filtering option, which would have actually been a chemical option, but kind of found a new pumpless filter solution that ended up working really well, and it kind of fit that need of being fast and light, and those were the two things that I really needed. I looked at each piece of gear that I brought with me, and it kind of needed to meet those things. It needed to be the lightest possible, but it also needed to be the fastest possible. And so if there was a lighter option that was going to take more time, I didn't go with an option like that in exchange for something that was a little bit faster.
How heavy was your pack?
The base weight of my gear was 4.9 pounds. And with my food, all my food, I think it was 15 or 16 pounds. And then at the very start of my event, I was carrying 4 liters of water for the first 23 to 25 mile dry section. And I think total, it was about 20 pounds. And then including all the clothes I was wearing, I think I was carrying 23 pounds of you know, total weight, skin out.
JB, did you mention the type of filter that you chose by brand, in case there's some people like me?
I'll guess. I know what it is.
What is it?
It was a Sawyer, right?
That's right. Yeah, they just came out with a new one, the Sawyer Mini, which weighs 2 ounces.
Yep.
Is that the pen?
No. The Sawyer is this. There's the Sawyer Squeeze, but then they came out with a new one that I have got to get my hands on. It's called the Sawyer Mini, which is, it's just a gravity-fed filter. It's really good.
JB, Scott is a gear geek of gear geeks. I mean, he subscribes to alcohol-burning stove kits, so he always knows what's new and what's next.
I have too many alcohol stoves.
If you need a good alcohol stove, well, Scott's probably, he could share one.
Yeah, well, I'm also right along with you with those alcohol stoves, but for this thing, I actually went with something completely different. Not completely different, but I went with this Foster's beer can stove mug combo that I could cook meal with, but used solid state fuel. So it was like pretty much the lightest option, and it had multiple uses. So I could use my stove as a mug that I was also eating my meals out of and mixing Vitargo in, and just using it as kind of a nice multi-purpose utensil, essentially.
Okay, so that's interesting to me. You were actually cooking? So you were eating hot meals on this?
Yeah, I cooked two hot meals, and I also ate two, you know, just normal granola with milk meals. So I had four kind of regular meals, and the rest was all just snacking and, you know, just constant eating. In fact, I was eating so constantly that my jaw was sore, really sore, actually.
Hey, can we get your time for this? Because I don't think we've discussed that. How many hours did this take you to get around the lake?
So it took me, I got lost for about 3 miles, which is probably about an hour, but it took me 58 hours and 43 minutes and 12 seconds. So that was, I guess, a little over 5 hours faster than the previous record.
Congratulations.
That's awesome.
Thank you.
I got to know, when you're coming into the quote-unquote finish line, are you sprinting? Are you? What does that look like when you finish? Because you say 12 seconds, and it's like, what? I mean, what does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't care about the seconds, but you know, they do keep the seconds on the thing. So, yeah, you know, when I hit mile, what was that? Probably close to about mile 150, Mount Rose Meadows. I did one last kind of regroup. My feet were pretty blistered up, and my knee was swelling, and I looked at the time. I had 23 miles to go, and I was kind of thinking, oh, I could cracking 60 hours would be hard. 23 miles in 7 hours was going to be tough, because that's more than 3 mile an hour pace. And so I don't know, I just, something snapped in me. I was kind of, I'll go more into this in a minute, but I was delirious. I was like seeing people and talking to my leg and my camelback and my poles, and they were like all individual characters, and it was really strange. I was like super delirious. But anyway, at some point, somebody was, you know, hiking with me, and this person convinced me that I should just start running. And so I did, and I started running probably 4 to 5 mile an hour pace on anything that was flat or down. And it actually felt pretty good, because it was just a different pace, and my feet were so sore that it was just a different like landing position on those blisters. And so I ended up actually running that last 23 miles, which has quite a bit of climbing. It's the 23 miles that they use on the Tahoe Rim 50 and 100 mile races. There's at least two really big climbs. You go up to like 9,700 feet. And I ran that section in like 6 hours flat, pretty much, which was probably my fastest 23 miles of the whole thing. And the last 7 or 10 miles, I ran, you know, pretty much almost all the way. It's downhill, but I ran the whole thing. And then, sprinted across the line with Jen there, and had my friend who was taking some video, and my dad showed up. And it was an awesome feeling.
We talked about 174 total miles, but what about the elevation change, the vertical climb on that, and maybe descent if you have that?
You know, I don't have that information, actually. Felt like a lot. I don't know. That's one number I do need to find out. I guess I didn't think too much about that beforehand, and I haven't really added it up since. I know most of the trail kind of by heart, and so I just kind of think about it in terms of climb number one, climb number two, climb number three. I don't really add up all the numbers on that in that respect, so I'll have to get back to you on that. But I'm sure somebody out there does know, so maybe we can get some input.
Yeah. You know, I've been trying to picture this. I've spent a little bit of time in Desolation Wilderness, but I don't think I've spent time in the area that the Tahoe Rim Trail goes. I know that it goes right by Aloha Lake, right?
Yes.
So are there any giant climbs through Desolation Wilderness where you're climbing up and over, you know, passes?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a long, slow climb from Echo Lake up to Aloha Lake, and then there's a short descent down to Susie Lake, and then you do another big climb up to Dick's Pass, which is probably one of the two highest points on that west side of the lake. I think I don't know the exact height of Dick's Pass, but it's pretty high. It took me a while to get up there. Then the other high point is kind of right before you come into Tahoe City. I think it's Twin Peaks area, and you're pretty high up over there as well. So the west side has two pretty big points that you need to get to. The north side, you've got Mount Rose or Relay Peak, which is over 10,200 feet. And then the east side, you have Marlette Peak, you have Snow Valley Peak, you have almost like Genoa Peak, and then you come up over the shoulder of Friel Peak, which is nearly 10,900 feet. So, which I think the highest point on the trail is Relay Peak. It's about 10,200. So you have a lot of climbs that are up over 9,700 feet, though.
Now, JB, I have a hard time packing for a weekend trip. I've got a bag that's stuffed that you would think that I'm going for a month. I couldn't imagine packing not only clothes, but perhaps calories. Because you're going to be out there 60 some odd hours. You're thinking, you know, 60, it might be the target or the goal. I would have a hard time trying to figure out, because I would never have done something like that, how many calories do I want to pack? Am I going to need even more calories than I would? I can't just take a 20-mile run and then multiply it many times over, because I don't know what's going to happen to my body when I'm out there. I might all of a sudden need more calories, and I don't want to blow this thing because I'm not carrying enough. So walk us through how you figured that out.
Well, I guess if you normally take 2 days to pack for a month-long trip, then this took a month to pack for a two-day trip.
All right.
I started actually the final, I think, I don't know, tipping point of deciding that I was going to do this was when I helped crew Mike Wolf and Hal Kerner on their successful John Muir Trail, fastest known time that they just did in August. And then, so in August, I just kind of decided I was going to do this, and I started, you know, working on gear, you know, just working on the plan, working on the maps, and, you know, also going out and doing sections of the trail that I hadn't done yet, looking for where the water was, because we had a really dry year, so a lot of the water sources were dried up, so I needed to know exactly where the water was for this particular year. Couldn't rely on, like, you know, a typical, yeah, normally there's water here, but this year there isn't sort of thing. So there was that. And then I actually did, I think it was the most helpful thing, I did a 60-mile test hike on September 6th. I hiked from Echo Lake to Spooner Summit. And so I not only learned that whole section, but also made a ton of mistakes and got those all out of the way. Made some gear adjustments, figured out about how much food I was consuming, realized that my normal running shoes were not going to cut it for this type of mileage with having that much weight on my back. So then I actually reached out to Jen, my wife's sponsor, Hoka, and they were kind enough to send me a pair of the new Rapa Nuis that they are going to be releasing shortly. And yeah, that was huge. That was a game changer right there. I'm not like a Hoka fan. It was the first time I'd ever worn them. But on my test hike, I was like seriously beat up and sore by about mile 45 to 50. My feet were just bruised. My joints were aching. My back was hurting. And with those Hokas, I made it to about mile 105 before I felt any sort of, you know, discomfort pretty much at all. Wow. It was like unbelievable. And, you know, I was just thinking that it would be good just for my feet. I didn't realize what it was going to do for my joints and my back and that sort of thing. So that is my my sales pitch for something that I don't actually, you know, receive any income from. But I really think that was a game changer right there.
Tell me, you mentioned that you made some mistakes on that test run. What other mistakes would you want to share?
I think I made at least two, if not three. I made three big mistakes. One mistake was that I got lost. I wasn't actually lost. There was a sign that had been cut down, and the way that seemed the most obvious just didn't quite seem right. It was this part where you ended up walking on this dirt, very steep, uncharacteristically steep dirt road for a while, for like, you know, 200-300 yards. And I kept walking back and forth on that thing, like looking for a trail junction, looking for some sort of sign, looking for something, and I just could not find anything. So I probably added an extra few miles on that. So then, you know, just navigation was one thing. The second mistake I made was, you know, I was following the guidebook, and I hit what was, you know, I hit some a running creek, which was at Mott Creek, by kind of over by Heavenly Ski Resort, and it was running and it was fine, but it said on the guidebook, it said that Mott Creek was kind of a seasonal creek and don't rely on it. Instead, rely on this other creek, Daggett Creek, because it's much more reliable. And so I bypassed this running creek, got another 3 miles down the trail, and found that this other creek that they said was more reliable was completely dry. So now I'm out of water and I have 25 miles to hike and no water. So then I had to hike off the trail to get water, which added miles and time and frustration. And then I ended up sleeping that night, and I set my alarm. It was my third mistake, to only sleep for 2 hours so I could make my goal of making 60 miles within 24 hours, and woke up 5.5 hours later. My alarm didn't go off or something. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, all three of those things, you know, would have been game enders on the, you know, on the real hike. So, and then the other thing I just learned, you know, was just, I needed to get the gear weight down even further. And so I dumped the sleeping bag, even though it was lightweight. I dumped a lot of like gear, that I didn't need, you know, just things that I would carry at PCT or I would carry on a John Muir thing. But on something like this, I just said, you know, I don't need it on this. I can survive without this sort of thing. So I dumped a lot of gear as well.
So you mentioned a sleeping bag. I mean, did you, on the actual, record setting circumnavigation, did you sleep?
I tried to, as I mentioned earlier, the winds were just phenomenally strong. And so I had a goal of trying to hike my minimum mileage that I need to hike within 24 hours was 65 miles. But after I got pretty far into it, I was thinking, oh, you know, I could make like 72 miles, which would be like, you know, that'd be really awesome. And so, I made it to actually mile, I guess it was like 69, within, let's see, it must've been like about 6 a.m. So I guess that's 21 hours. So I still had 3 hours. So I said, all right, I'm going to sleep for an hour and then get up and knock out, you know, some more miles so I can try to get to 72 before 24 hours. And so I laid down next to Lake Susie, which is just past Lake Aloha. And I got into my emergency bivy sack, and the wind was just so ferocious that it was just turning my bivy sack into like a, I don't know, like just rifling around and just slapping me, you know, all over the place. And so I laid there for probably about 25 minutes. Don't think I actually fell asleep. Just kind of was nice to get off my feet for a minute. And then I just got back up and kept going, and actually ended up making it, I think, like 73 miles. I made it to Dix Lake on the first 24 hours. So I was, you know, 8 miles past my minimum goal. So that was awesome. And then, yeah, and then I just, you know, I was kind of up at that point, so I just cranked through the whole next day. But then coming down, I got to about a mile 105. And then, like I said, that's about where my body finally started to exhibit some signs of soreness. I could tell my feet were starting to get a little blistered. And was coming down into Tahoe City. And I decided I'm going to try to sleep for 90 minutes here in Tahoe City and get out of here by about, you know, 10 p.m. And so I actually went, soaked my feet in the river, refilled my water. And then it actually felt really good on my feet to just walk barefoot. So I walked barefoot on the gravel for like a quarter mile. And then I just found like a comfy place, which I had actually pre-scouted, like a comfy little place with pine needles. And I just laid there. But I think it was a combination of the air temperature and also just my body kind of realizing what it had been going through. But I slept for maybe like 30, 40 minutes. And then I just started to kind of shake uncontrollably, and it didn't feel that cold out to me, so I think it was kind of just my body, you know, reacting to the what it was undergoing. And so I ended up getting up again, cooked my second meal, actually took that to go and ate that while I was hiking. And and then I came into the section where between Tahoe City and Brockway, that it was the one section I hadn't done before, and started going through there. And that's when the hallucinations really started kicking in. And I, you know, it was really weird. I had never hiked that section before, but it was this really visceral experience, as though I knew every turn. I'd been there before. I knew every rock. And I couldn't help but just think of, like, you know, Michael Popov going through there and, you know, somehow he, you know, giving me these visions or something. It was just like really interesting experience. And then after I kind of snapped out of that, I realized, oh, I'm just here by myself. Then I started to doubt myself. And I'm like, I'm going the wrong way. I'm completely lost. And then that's when I turned around, started going the wrong way for 2 miles.
How did you figure out you were going the wrong way when you're going the wrong way?
Well, because I started overthinking it. I was like heading, and I was like, there's lights on the left of me. There shouldn't be lights on the left of me. The lake is on the right of me. But it turns out, you know, after looking back at it, there was just this huge, like, switchback that was going the wrong way, and then it kind of came back around. But just having those lights on the wrong side of me, and, like, I was looking at the stars, and I was trying to figure out where I was, and so I had started hiking the wrong way for about a mile and a half or 2 miles, and then I realized, no, that must have been right, and then I went back again, and then, yep, sure enough, if I would have just went another 200 yards past where I had stopped, I would have figured it out, but so that was my one part where I got lost.
So is is a map or compass or GPS, that's all considered aid, correct?
Well, everything, I guess, would theoretically be considered aid, like, you know, food and water, but well, far as I know, as long as you can carry it yourself.
Okay.
I think it's legitimate. You carry it from the beginning. You're not grabbing it along the way.
Right. So what was your mode of, did you use a GPS watch or a compass, or what was your weapon of choice?
I used the GPS. It's like a Garmin 401 Fortrex, because it has replaceable batteries. So I could, you know, every 18 hours, I would just pop in 2 more AAAs. So it would keep the counter running, essentially. And then I had a map, but for most of it, I actually never even used any of that, because I knew most of the trail except for that one section. Like I said, I was just disoriented and confused and overthinking it. If I would have just not even thought about it, I probably would have been fine, but because I was overthinking it, got me in trouble. But then, yeah, after that was when I really started having bad hallucinations, and I was really like, kind of from there to the finish, I essentially was kind of having this out of body experience where my consciousness was kind of floating in front of my face, and all of my limbs were like their own people or characters that I was having conversations with. Like, I felt like my water needed to have water, and like my foot, I was mad at it because it wasn't stopping to fix a blister that it was getting. And then my knee was hurting, so I was mad at my knee. And I said, I'm going to stop up here and give you some Advil so that you can keep moving with me. You got to keep up with me. It was like we were this hiking team that we all had to work together. It was weird. And then every like 30 minutes to an hour, I'd snap out of it and realize that I was just there by myself. But it was like so much more comfortable to just be in this like zoned out place that I just kept slipping back into it. And so for the rest of the hike, I was just really, really loopy.
The mind is so powerful. Yeah. You know, if it was more comfortable that way, then your mind, very likely, since we're, you know, making things up here, very likely created that to give you comfort and to allow you to hit your goal. And the mind's amazing.
I agree. Because whenever I would sit there and realize that I was completely out there by myself, it would kind of freak me out. But then I would just drift into this place where it was like we were this hiking team and we were all doing this together, and just felt a lot more comfortable to know that there was other people suffering out there with me.
Yeah, I think I might live every day like that. I might start right now. I kind of like that.
I was going to say that my next long race, I think I'm going to use that disassociation tip.
Yeah. Hey, I've got a question for you, JB. You've got, you know, we do these, you too, your race resume is large and full, and anybody that looks will see that you're just not a person that's set a fastest known time. You've been on all the major races and have placed very well. So as we're out there on these trail runs, regardless of the distance, we become somewhat like ribbon junkies. It's like, oh, where's my next ribbon?
Right.
I need to make sure that I'm on the right course. Oh, there's a Y up here in the road. I better look to make sure there's at least a ribbon telling me there's a Y, and then a ribbon at the Y, and then a ribbon right after the Y, so I feel secure that I've gone the right way. What in the heck? And I know you know that trail out there, but for those that maybe are going to a new area to try to create a fastest known time, I've got to think trail marking and navigation would be just super, super critical.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I haven't talked to one person, actually, not even supported people that have gone for a Tahoe Rim fastest known time that have done it successfully without getting lost at all. I haven't talked to one person, supported or otherwise. So I think it's just part of the experience, you know, just trying your best to not get lost or minimize the mistakes, as David Horton says. But I think to a certain extent, it's kind of inevitable, especially when you start getting really tired and out of it and your mind's not functioning in a way that it should. Yeah. So, I mean, maps, just constantly double checking, you know, trying to constantly kind of keep your wherewithal about direction, like which way is which, so that you know, of course it failed me a little bit because I actually was kind of sensing I was going the wrong direction, but it was just a temporary wrong direction thing. So that kind of failed me in that respect. But yeah, you know, and the good thing about the Tahoe Rim Trail for the most part and the PCT is that they do a decent job of marking it. There are some tricky intersections and things, but for the most part, there's usually some sort of blaze or, you know, PCT logo or TRT logo of some sort. So I do give them credit for that, though. With the money that we raised for the fundraiser for MISH, I'm hoping that the Tahoe Rim Trail Association will put in a sign or something in that place where I got lost.
You know, it's a good thing that you did this before the government closed down.
Yeah, I think it happened when I was out there, but yeah.
You were grandfathered in. I heard that the people were hiking, you know, through hiking and stuff like that. They were still allowed through those national forest lands, so you were lucky.
Yeah, I didn't hear about it until I came back. I was like, what's going on?
What does recovery from an event like this look like?
Well, you know, just a lot of sleeping, tons of sleeping. I've been really tired. And then, you know, my one kind of, I don't know, issue is my knee got swollen up about twice the size of normal. And so the day right after was really a struggle. I felt bad for Jen because I couldn't even move. I was just laying in bed, and Eva was sick and she was vomiting. So Jen's got me laid up in bed. Eva's vomiting. She's supposed to be working, and she, you know, it was just a crazy day for her. But you know, today is almost a week out, and I'm moving around fine. I am getting a little physical therapy on my knee, and it was just mostly an alignment thing. And you know, after 175 miles, certain muscles and things kind of give out, and then when one gives out, there, you know, it puts pressure on other systems, and you know, that's pretty much what happened. So They basically just said that running 175 miles is probably not the best idea. So.
You go into the
What do they know?
You go into the therapist and say, my knee is a little swollen. What did you do? I just ran the Tahoe Rim Trail in under 60 hours. Well, you should be swollen. That's what the body is meant to do. Okay, so here's my question. We didn't lead with this question, but I think we should start talking about it here near the end of our podcast. Where do you come up with this idea? And I get a sense from talking to you today that, you know, you've hiked the Pacific Crest Trail, which is a dream of mine, and you have you told us that you supported Hal, and who was the other guy that hiked with
Mike
Hal?
Mike Wolf.
Sorry, yeah. you can edit that out.
Will do, pal. I'll take care of it. No one will hear that.
You supported them on their John Muir Trail fastest known time. Have you done a fastest known time attempt? Or, you know, why did you get this in your head? You know, I'm going to go try this. And I guess to couple that question with another question, what was the furthest distance you had run before attempting this?
You mean like in training or just total?
Like
in total.
Yeah. No, like
that's
like,
what you meant, Scott.
Like a race, like a race, or what was the furthest race or other fastest known time attempt?
Yeah, this is my first official fastest known time attempt. I had only done 100 milers up to this point, other than the PCT. But on the PCT, my longest thing was something we call the Pyramid of Death, where we did a 30, 40, 50, 40, 30, in that order. So, you know, still not to the level of what I just did, but those are probably some of the most, you know, long things that I'd done. In terms of the idea, you know, doing some sort of fastest known time thing has been kind of on my mind since about 2005, probably. Well, I mean, I helped David Horton on the PCT when he set the speed record, and that's what the Runner film is about. And so that obviously was some motivation. And then, you know, kind of started thinking about gear. Like, if I was to do something like this, what would I carry? You know, so I've been, over the last few years, always just kind of obsessed with gear and thinking about that. But I guess the tipping point, you know, just living here in Tahoe, you know, I've been letting Jen kind of do her race schedule over the last year and haven't been really racing too much myself. And so I was just like, you know, I'm just going to set one big goal for myself for the year, and I'm going to go out and do this Tahoe Rim thing. It's in my backyard. You know, I want to honor Michael Popov, Mish Popov, you know, in his tragic death, but yet his spirit, you know, of doing these amazing things. And you know, I just also, you know, feel like it's, you know, if running is the simplest sport in the world, then something like this is probably the simplest form of competition. You're completely alone. There's no one out there to push you. There's no aid stations. There's no nothing really. And so I just like that simplicity and aloneness and really just getting down to dealing with your own issues, I guess.
JB, can you compare running 100 miles with aid stations and people cheering for you and the cowbells versus what you've just accomplished?
They're kind of two different things. Like, I don't know. I like both of them, but they're just completely different, I guess. One of them is just, I don't know. Like I said, it's just so simple and pure. You know, I mean, but I also just love the camaraderie of ultra races and the people out there. I mean, for me, that's the best part of it. And so I wouldn't want to do only this type of thing. I'd feel like a trail hermit.
We've talked to Adam Bradley before. He is a trail hermit.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, he likes it out there, just solo and spending time with himself. And, you know, I think you've woken something up in me, JB. I think I could get out there and hang out with myself for a little while and not feel the pressures of maybe coming into an aid station or trying to run faster than what I had done last. Just hanging out, getting it done. I think that'd be fun.
Scott, how do you feel? Do you think you could do something like that?
I would love to. I don't know whether I have it in me, but I have
I've loved the whole idea of fast packing and you know, fast packed the Western States Trail before I ran it. And I loved that whole idea. Now, we weren't trying to break any speed records, but we were trying to do, you know, so many miles a day. And then we slept for a good night and ate real food.
It's a personal journey. And, you know, you've got yourself to rely on, the gear and what you've brought with you. And so I think it would be an empowering experience just to, it would certainly be a memory maker.
The thing is, as JB was talking about this, that I would have the toughest time with is on the long hikes that I've done, when you know, you have your map, you have your GPS, and you come to a place and you go, okay, it says that I should go this way. Do I go this way? Do I go that way? And then you second guess yourself. And that's on a clear mind, you know, where JB was starting to talk about, you know, after, you know, 80 miles, 100 miles, when he started seeing and talking to his body parts, that's when I think that would be the unraveling for me. Just I'd question myself too much.
JB, what were the toughest miles? If you were there, 174 miles, what sections did you go to the dark side, the tough side, and then pop back out? What did that roller coaster look like?
Yeah, you know, I've looked back at this hike, and as far as I can tell, it was like almost flawless. There was two things, I think, that were kind of low points. One was the story I just mentioned, where I kind of went the wrong way for a while and felt really disoriented. And then the only other thing was at about mile 45, I had some weird, you know, but typical, you know, bonk type syndrome going on, where I wasn't able to really get any food in. I was feeling really sluggish. I just wanted to lay down. I was kind of vomiting a little bit here and there, and kind of laid down by this creek for about 5 or 10 minutes and just pretty much wanted to give up. And that was probably the lowest point. It was the only point where I actually had doubt. But I just slowly got up from that, kind of kept moving, knew that I just need to get more calories, and I just forced myself to just keep eating. And about 10 miles later, I kind of popped out of that funk. And then, yeah, it was pretty smooth sailing, other than, you know, typical blisters and swelling of body parts and weird things like that and hallucinations. But nothing that, like, really made me doubt that I could do it.
If you're going to set a record, you have to have a day that all comes together.
Yeah.
You know, if you're your personal best, you think on all of your personal best, either training runs or races, it's just everything seemed to gel and work. Do you see yourself doing this again? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. You know, and speaking to that, I think part of the reason that it went so well is because I didn't put a ton of pressure on myself. I actually almost had more of a thought that I wouldn't make it on my first attempt, and I was just using it as more of like a trial run, and I was going to come back next year after I was in real good shape from training, you know, through the season. But, you know, I took it super casually. You know, I basically worked a normal week, and then on Saturday, you know, I just hung out with my daughter, and then my wife and I went to like the football game, and then we went out to a dinner and had some wine, and then woke up the next morning. I'm like, oh yeah, 175 miles today. I better start packing. I mean, I was already kind of packed, but, you know, I had to put the finishing touches on it. And so, you know, and then I just got out there and I was just really enjoying it. Not like, you know, I didn't have a lot of pressure on myself. And so I think that was really important, because I wasn't like, it wasn't rushing it. I wasn't pushing myself too hard. I was just being consistent. And I think that really made a huge difference to get me far enough down the line where my, you know, where the pull of the finish could bring me in. And I think that really made a big difference.
Do you see yourself doing this again, either a fastest known time or taking another trip around this lake?
I probably won't do the Tahoe Rim Trail again until, at least in that manner, until, you know, maybe if somebody beats it. I think, you know, with really good shape, some more hours could be shaved off of that. But I'll probably just wait, let a few other people try it, and then maybe in the future do that again. While I was out there, I said, you know, I was thinking of Hal and Mike out on the John Muir Trail. And I'm like, there's no way I'd ever do that. That's ridiculous. But then, of course, you know, just like any old trail, you get back, and 3 days later, you know, the thoughts start popping through your mind. Oh, that was cool. I want to go try something else. And I started looking at like the Colorado Trail unsupported time and the John Muir Trail unsupported time and what other trails can I do? And I don't know. So yeah, there's definitely some thoughts. It's nothing solid yet, but of course the pain always goes away more quickly than the joy. So you end up in those situations again.
Have you ever had a race where you had these grandiose hallucinations like you experienced, or was that new for you?
That was totally new. I've had, like, during 100 milers, I've seen things, which I was also seeing things, too. Like, I would, like, see, like, a what I thought was a voodoo doll or something on the side of the trail, and just turns out it was, like, a stump, or, you know, I've seen things like that where I'm just, like, mistaking things in the forest for different things, but I never, like, been in a state where I was like completely convinced I was with other people, and like, I don't know, I've never gone that far into it, but I've also never stayed up for, you know, 58 hours minus maybe an hour of lie down time.
On a real long, you know, trail run, whether it's 50K or 100 mile, doesn't matter, because they're all long when you're out there and you're running hard and getting tired. It seems like every whatever aid station, 6 or 8 miles, that's an opportunity then to maybe get in the most comfortable seat, turn on the heater or the air conditioner, and you know, move on and get to easier spot. But when you're out there by yourself on your own, there is no quit. There's no exit. There's just complete. I've got to think.
Well, there's a lot of opportunity to drop out for sure, but you know, because you cross roads on this particular trail, John Muir Trail is a little different, but on Tahoe Rim Trail, you're crossing roads about every 20 to 30 miles probably. And so there are opportunities to quit for sure, but to be honest with you, other than that one time when I laid down, the thought never even crossed my mind.
How do you train for something like this? You mentioned that this is the longest you had stayed up without getting any sleep. I mean, how did you train for it?
You know, like I said, I didn't have a lot of confidence in myself that I could do it this year because I haven't been training that much. Because I'm actually opening a new film studio here in Reno called Studio Benna, and so that's going to be consuming a lot of my time. And so my training essentially has been do a 20 to 30 mile run on the long weekend, a long run on the weekend, and that's essentially all I've been doing. And then the only specific training I did for this was go out and do that 160 mile test hike. So yeah, I didn't really have a lot of confidence that I was in the shape to do it, because I wasn't like running 6 days a week like I normally do when I'm going into a 100 miler. But I was just out there to have fun, and it turned out to be a really good experience.
Hey, JB, tell us about this new studio that you have. What are you doing?
Well, you know, we're actually building a physical studio here in the Reno area. It'll be the headquarters for Journey Film, but it will also be doing commercial production out of there, and TV production, and other, you know, non-outdoor adventure-related film production. So that's how I pay the bills. The outdoor stuff is fun, but it doesn't cover everything. So I also do commercial production and television production and other types of film production. So that'll be called Studio Benna. And it will be right here in Reno. And it's exciting. It should be open in the next month.
So if I'm out there listening to this podcast, how would I know that you could help me? What area do you serve the best?
Well, I mean, a lot of people listen to this podcast, probably, you know, adventure people. So we still will be doing adventure film production or brand production for outdoor companies. But we also will do, you know, any sort of creative, marketing, creative production. Our studio will be able to handle film production, live television, audio production, and design work. So it should be fairly full-fledged, and, excited about it.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, excellent. We appreciate your time, JB. We were following you on Facebook the entire weekend, and we're thrilled for you. We think it's been a great time to learn from you, and I think you've at least intrigued the interest in three of us. And I don't know. Did he increase some? You like suffering, Faith?
I do.
This could be the perfect suffer fest for you. We'll design your fastest known time trail.
You know what? We should do that for her.
We didn't get into females that have done this, and I'd be really interested to see how.
There is a female.
I know there is. And I say, I mean, I can't even imagine being out there. I mean, in addition to packing your gear and your food, you have to pack some sort of defense mechanism, and that takes up a bunch of weight.
Yeah, I was just reading it. It's Betsy Nye, I think, according to the fastest known time. She did it in 55 hours, but I think that was a supported effort.
Hmm. Yeah, actually, Jenny Capel from Reno just broke that 53 hours about two months ago. But yeah, you know, I don't know. It's not listed on the fastest known time site. I think Sarah Spelt has completed the trail unsupported. I just don't think it was the time that she was posting. So there are some people that are out there doing the trail unsupported, some women. But I just don't think a lot of them have kind of made it public or gone for the record yet. So there is an opportunity if any ladies want to go out and hike the trail, give me a call. I'll hook you up with some gear ideas and some maps and go out and do it.
That's very cool. You know, the one question I didn't ask that it just came back to me, how many people did you see out there while you were doing this? Of course, at night you probably didn't see a whole lot of people, but did you run into quite a few hikers?
Not too many. I mean, it was, as I said, like gale force, 60, 70 mile an hour winds, you know, where it was almost ripping my backpack off my back, for most of the time. So I don't think a lot of people were too thrilled to just be out doing day stuff. So I think I probably only saw, to be honest with you, about 12 people the whole time. Mm. I actually did ask four of those people to kind of tweet me or take a photo of me or something just as an extra verification. And I may get at least one of those back. This one girl did take a photo of me. And I think when she gets done with her hike, she's going to post it. But yeah, there wasn't a lot of people out there. It was really kind of nasty conditions, but so, you know, actually not bad for me. Though it was very windy, that served two purposes. One, it kept me awake, and two, it kept it a little cooler because I think 70 degrees would have been a little warm.
So as you're coming up on these people, and you know, you may or may not be in a talking mood when you come up on them, but I mean, when you, like this lady that took the picture of you, did you say, yeah, I'm trying to break the record, and I'm trying to I'm trying to run.
No, actually, it was the opposite. I was going up the hill, and this young girl like comes steaming past me. I'm like, oh my gosh, she's got like a full backpack on and big calves, and I'm like, wow. I was like, wow, you hiking the whole trail? She's like, yeah, I'm doing it in like 8 days. I was like, that's impressive. I was like, I'm hiking the whole trail too. She's like, really? She looks at my backpack, which is, you know, very small. And she's like, how long are you doing it? I was like, oh, like 58 hours. She's like, wow. And then we just kind of started this conversation because her like slowest pace was about as fast as I could go at that time. So we were kind of going back and forth. And then we ended up reaching the top of Relay Peak together. And she snapped a photo of me. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
I would ask her for a Fig Newton or something. I said, man, that sure looks good. Can I,
you know what?
Can I please have that?
You don't want to jeopardize the record for a freaking Fig Newton.
Oh, those Fig Newtons are good.
That Fig Newton made my record 20 hours slower than Killian's time because I ate the Fig Newton.
what was the first thing that you ate or drank when you got done?
My wife and dad took me down to In-N-Out Burger and ate that. But to be honest with you, somebody was asking me if there was like some food I was craving or something, and I really wasn't. I was my jaw was so sore and my mouth was so puckered up from all the sugar that I didn't want to eat anything. My mouth was a disaster. So I didn't have that typical like, oh, I got to get back and have a beer and a pizza sort of, you know, thing. But I did lose 10 pounds, so that was quite a bit for two days.
I think In-N-Out should start their own ultra-running team. When Tim Tweetmeyer and Dean Karnazes and I think Bill Finkbeiner, when they went and did the winter crossing on the Western States course, in the middle, I think it was Michigan Bluff, they had some In-N-Out burgers brought to them. That was their meal of choice along the way. So
well, our friend Bill Carr takes McDonald's cheeseburgers with him on runs.
We need
the future of fast food restaurants, ultra-running teams.
Exactly.
And we want to remind people to get a hold of JB's film Unbreakable, because if you need a little bit of motivation, like you're just seem to be in a rut. Watch that film and see the energy of Western State, see the energy of Anton, Howell, Jeff Rose, and Killian, because these guys are spectacular runners. There's energy through that film, and what a story, what an ending. No spoiler alert, but wow.
It's a great movie to watch before the night before your race.
Yeah, or any time. I really enjoyed it. You told a great story there. You picked a perfect year for a story that, JB. I mean, but all years have their special stories, but this one was one of those great years.
JB must have like a lucky charm in his pocket or something, because everything just comes together for him, doesn't it?
It sure has.
I don't know about that. That was like, you know, when you film every year at Western States from 2005 to 2013, you eventually will capture one that's pretty amazing. And so that was just how that worked out. But yes, I do consider myself lucky in a lot of ways.
Yeah, very humble man, well, athlete.
Go to journeyfilm.com. We'll link that there, because there's a lot of really good videos. And when I was looking, there's a couple I didn't know that JB had done that I may have to break down and brought by. It's better than going to Netflix.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So thanks, JB. We appreciate it. And best of luck to your new studio.
Yes.
Best of luck to any races you have coming up and training. And for now, just sit back, kick those feet up. You hold the record, sir, for the fastest known time.
Congratulations.
Unsupported around Tahoe Rim Trail.
Thanks, guys, and thanks for what you do. You guys do a lot for the sport, so I appreciate it.
We have a lot of fun talking to some very cool people. It's pretty easy to do.
Yeah. Now, Nation members, thanks for listening. Go to trailrunnernation.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Go out and run.
Moss. I'm coming over. See me down at the station by the lane with my hands in my pocket, jingling a wish coin. That I stole from a fountain that was down on the cares in the world. When I get older, climbing up on the back porch fence just to see the dogs running with the ring and a question. And my shivering voices singing through a crack. Na, 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 na. I better go away.